Harry, it's just too late to do anything. The peacekeepers are already there. Look. She pointed to the wall screen again. Turning in the rocker, her staff chief saw dozens of tracked vehicles advancing slowly toward the main airlock hatch of Moonbase. Suddenly, the picture winked off. What the hell? Before the president could reach the remote control unit on her desk, the screen flicked a few times, then showed a harried-looking announcer in a suit and tie. We regret to report that technical difficulties have cut off Edie Elgin's report from Moonbase. We are trying to re-establish contact. As the scene switched to a news anchor woman who began to summarize what they had been watching live, the president eased back in her desk chair and cast a knowing look at her staff chief. It's all over, bar the shouting, Harry. Moonbase is finished, and all those jerks who were yelling at you will forget about it by this time tomorrow. Doug wished he could talk with Edith now that her marathon performance had been cut short, but he had no time for that. He watched the advancing peacekeeper troops. So did everyone in Moonbase. In the control center, in the cave, in the infirmary and labs that were still working, every resident of Moonbase looked at the screens and held his or her breath. Doug had never heard the control center so absolutely silent. Even the hum of the machinery seemed muted. The white peacekeeper tractors edged cautiously through the airlock. Big as it was, the airlock could only accommodate two vehicles at a time, so the invading tractors came in pairs, then deployed around the edges of the garage. "They're expecting us to fire at them," Gordette said, almost whispering. Still, his voice broke the silence jarringly. "With what?" Anson muttered acidly. Doug looked past Vince Falcone to Nick O'Malley. "Ready with the dust?" he asked, also in a near-reverent whisper. "Ready and waiting," O'Malley replied firmly. Doug nodded as he thought, "Waiting. We've been waiting a long time, but we won't have to wait much longer." "The garage is clear," Giap heard in his earphones. "No enemy troops." The colonel had established his command post just outside the main airlock, where he could see easily into the broad, brightly lit garage. Four teams of specialists were sweeping the garage floor with powerful ultraviolet lamps. So far, there was no sign of nanomachines, but Giap did not want to take any chances. His teams would sterilize the hatches on the other end of the garage as well, the hatches that led into Moonbase's corridors. "No opposition so far," Giap mused. "Either they intend to surrender once we enter the corridors and occupy their critical centers, or they have a trap waiting for us inside." He played his plan through his mind once again. The first wave of troops were to open the corridor hatches. They were airlocks, of course, double hatches that protected the corridors from the vacuum outside. They had been built as a secondary level of protection, since usually the garage was pressurized, and vehicles and personnel left it for the lunar surface through the oversized main airlock. If the rebels had sealed the hatches, Giap's men were under orders to blast them open. If they had been able to bring their missile launchers with them, they could have blown the hatches apart from where he was standing outside the main airlock. As it was, the lighter shoulder-fired missiles would have to do the job. The troops also had grenades. The hatches would pose no problem, Giap told himself. Once inside the base proper, his troops would quickly move to the water factory, the control center, the electrical distribution station, and the EVC, their environmental control center. Hold those and you command Moonbase. For good measure, Giap had assigned squads to the underground farming area and the nano laboratories. "Sir, the airlocks seem to be operating normally," one of his captains reported. "The outer hatches are not sealed. Repeat, not sealed." Giap suppressed a thrill of elation. So the rebels were going to surrender after all. "Have the outer hatches been UV sterilized?" he asked, still worrying about nanoweapons. "Yes, sir." "Very well. Open all the outer hatches," he commanded, "and check the inner hatches after they've been UV treated." "Yes, sir." "Don't congratulate yourself too soon," Giap warned himself. "There could still be ambushes, traps, inside those corridors." But he doubted it. What could the rebels do against armed troops in their midst? Corridor 1. Ulf Jansson's only distinguishing feature was that he was the tallest trooper in the Peacekeeper Battalion. At 193 centimeters, he towered over the Asians and Africans and Latinos who made up the bulk of the force. He dwarfed his commanding officer, Colonel Giap, and was a full head taller than Sergeant Slavodich, who headed his squad with an even-handed ferocity. An easy-going, likable Norwegian, Jansson had joined the peacekeepers mainly to earn a UN scholarship to engineering college. In the 4 years of his enlistment, he had been to Cyprus, Sri Lanka, the Malvinas Islands, which the British still insisted on calling the Falklands, and now he was on the moon. Another 3 months and his enlistment would be over. He could start college in the winter semester. He had been wounded slightly by an anti-personnel mine in Cyprus. Otherwise, his duties with the peacekeepers had not been truly dangerous. He had to wear a germ-proof biosuit most of the time in Sri Lanka, a real misery in all that heat, but it had been better than coming down with the man-made plagues that both sides had used in the last round of their civil war. Now he clumped into a smooth, metal-walled airlock, wearing a spacesuit that was much more comfortable than the biological protection gear from the Sri Lankan expedition. And everything was so light on the moon. Jansson hefted his assault rifle as easily as he'd carry a toothpick. "Move it up, move it up," his sergeant growled in the English that was the peacekeeper's basic language. The whole squad was filing through the airlock, one man at a time. So far, there'd not been the slightest sign of enemy opposition. As far as Jansson could tell, Moonbase might have been abandoned and left empty. Both airlock hatches were fully open. The Moonbase rebels had pumped all the air out of the corridor on the other side of the hatches, so the troopers were filing through the airlock as quickly as they could. The corridor on the other side of the hatch was dimly lit. Jansson could see another airlock about 100 meters down the tunnel. The sergeant brought up the rear. Once he stepped through the airlock, he hustled up to where the officers, two lieutenants and a captain, were standing, poring over a book-sized computer. "The water factory is on the other side of this hatch here," Jansson heard the captain saying as he tapped a gloved finger on the computer's tiny screen. "Down this corridor and through the cross..." Jansson's earphones erupted with a brain-piercing screech like electronic fingernails on an electronic blackboard. Jagged bursts of noise blasted at him. He put his hands to his ears, banged them into his helmet instead. The noise was painful, cutting through his skull like a surgeon's bone saw. He saw the other troopers clutching at their helmets, reeling, staggering under the agonizing assault of noise. Even the officers were flailing around helplessly. His eyes streaming tears from the pain, Jansson fumbled for the control stud on his wrist and shut off his suit radio. The noise cut off immediately. Blessed quiet. "What is it?" Giap screamed. "What's going on?" The noise assaulted his brain like 1,000 rock concerts all out of tune, like 1,000,000 jet planes taking off. He couldn't hear anything else. He couldn't speak to anyone. He couldn't think. All around him, the troops of his third wave were pawing at their helmets, tottering across the dusty lith in obvious agony, some of them falling to their knees. Giap did the only thing he could think of. He switched off his suit radio. The silence was like a soothing balm, even though his ears continued to ring. "Turn off your radios," he commanded, then felt immediately foolish. His own radio was off. His words never got farther than the padding inside his helmet. But he saw one by one his troopers were stopping their gyrations, standing still. Giap knew he himself was panting from the unexpected onslaught. He suspected the other troopers were too. He waved the captain of the third wave over to him as he yanked a communications wire from the thigh pouch of his suit. Plugging the wire into his helmet port, he handed it to the captain, who connected it to his own helmet. "Now we can talk without need of the radios," Giap said. "Yes, sir," replied the captain. Giap could hear his breathing, still heavy. "The rebels think they can stall our attack by jamming our suit radio frequencies," the colonel said with a hint of contempt. "Yes, sir," the captain said. "They didn't think that we can communicate directly by wire without using the radios." Yes, sir. But, sir,